Chapter 17. Arguing with the Dane. The disagreement between Einstein and most other quantum physicists first came to a head at the Brussels conference in October 1927. This was the same gathering where Lemaître buttonholed Einstein about the lambda. As if it weren't enough for him to be fending off one set of uncomfortable ideas, now he had two, and one fight would in time reinforce his determination in the other. If the meeting had taken place just a year earlier, Einstein would have enjoyed the support of many of his assembled colleagues. Up until that time, many of the attendees had shared Einstein's initial responses to Heisenberg's ideas. Before Heisenberg's imagined work with a gamma-ray microscope yielded the uncertainty principle in early 1927, physicists were sceptical about his theories regarding the quantum universe. They, like Einstein, were impressed that his early computations had had such success in accounting for how electrons responded to blasts of light, but weren't convinced that reality could be so unclear, so vaguely glued together, that at the most detailed level, we really had to accept uncertainty forever. When it emerged in February 1927, several months before the conference, however, the uncertainty principle robbed Einstein of many potential allies. The principle, most physicists agreed, did seem to show that views into the atom were inherently closed off. Heisenberg, they conceded, appeared to have been right, which meant that Einstein, whom many of his colleagues would have known to be disdainful of the younger scientist's theories, had to be wrong. Einstein had been invited to open the conference, since everyone wanted to see how he would deal with the new challenge from the quantum theorists, and how he would defend his traditional views about causality. He declined, however. He wasn't in a position to tell all of Europe's scientists what to think, not yet, and not in the magisterial way in which he'd been able to lay out the details of general relativity. His feelings were still a hunch, a suspicion, an almost visceral belief that an inner voice told him this could not be how the world worked. So Einstein sat politely through the opening sessions and watched as Niels Bohr stood up to weigh in on the issue. Now middle-aged, Bohr had become the leader of the pro-Heisenberg faction. As he'd aged, the odd appearance he'd had as a young man had become more attractive. His habit of speaking slowly and softly with long pauses for thought gave his words majesty. Bohr began the conference by recapping the changes that Europe's scientists, there were almost none of any significance at the time in the United States, had been experiencing. Since the decline of medieval scholasticism, Bohr recounted, there had been at least some efforts in the West to bring reason to bear on the material world. This was not a fettered reason, predetermined to come up with conclusions that matched what the church wanted to hear. Rather, this was a reason, an intellectual inquiry, that was convinced it could uncover every fact of nature, however laborious the process might be, and however many centuries it might take. This programme of inquiry took for granted the belief that what was out there, in the real world, truly existed, and could, in whatever detail we wished, ultimately be understood. That certainty about the universe was what these new findings seemed to be undermining, in Bohr's view, quite definitively. Causality of an absolute classical sort didn't exist. We might think there were exact sequences of events that must follow one another, kick a soccer ball hard, for instance, and it will spring forward, but that's just because we're seeing the averaged results of a vast number of sub-microscopic encounters, each one operating by chance. The electrons on a player's boot get very close to the electrons on the leather surface of a soccer ball as he swings his leg forward. That we can see, that we can know. But which of those electrons will repel one another, sending the ball flying away, can never, not even in principle, be entirely known. The uncertainty principle proved that these subatomic goings-on were unknowable, Bohr insisted. The micro-world really was different from the ordinary, large-scale world we're used to. On the smallest scale, chaos and indeterminacy ruled how the electrons and other particles that make up our bodies and planet operated. Clarity, at the micro-level, did not exist. Einstein had come to know the shambolic, brilliant Bohr very well over the years. At their first meeting in Berlin in 1920, Bohr had brought along Danish cheese and butter, which was much appreciated in a city still suffering from the recent British blockades. At another meeting in Copenhagen, they'd been so caught up in conversation, admittedly much of which must have been Einstein waiting as Bohr paused to put together his intense whispers, that they'd far overshot the streetcar stop for Bohr's home, turned around, and then overshot the stop coming back as well. They were the two wise men in their field, and they also liked each other. "Not often in life has a human being caused me such joy by his mere presence," Einstein once wrote to Bohr. He wasn't going to insult his old friend by mocking this most fundamental of new beliefs in public. Only outside the main sessions, after Bohr had publicly said his piece, did Einstein begin to argue back. Bohr presented a shambling front and took even longer than Einstein to get a pipe lit and keep the tobacco burning. He carried an extra large box of matches with him to help. But he was committed to physics, and in a certain sense to the cause of Professor Niels Bohr. His parents were prosperous and distinguished, and with the confidence from growing up with their connections, he'd arranged, despite the lumbering appearance he was the most skilled of bureaucratic operators, for the Carlsberg Foundation to support a great research institute under his direction in Copenhagen. Through scholarships, grants, and publications, that institute was doing everything it could to support the view that Bohr took of Heisenberg's and Born's results. It would be embarrassing if he were to be proved wrong. Instead of the leader of a new breakthrough in thought, he would look like a middle-aged professor who had jumped on the latest bandwagon simply to seem up to date. It still seemed possible, however, that Einstein would be able to prove Bohr wrong. All Einstein had to do was show how to construct one machine that could operate in contradiction to the uncertainty principle. If he did that, Bohr's support of the uncertainty principle would be shown to be empty. The possibility that Einstein could accomplish this was very real. Einstein was, after all, the man whose thought experiments about a falling elevator had led to startling, yet fully accurate predictions about starlight swerving near the sun, who had, in 1916, as just one of the more minor of his other thought experiments, envisaged a machine that could amplify light on call, the machine that would eventually become our laser. Who was to say that he could not solve this puzzle, too? Yet Einstein, like Bohr, had a lot on the line. At 48 years old, Einstein knew that he was nearing the point where physicists often go from creating fresh ideas to disparaging whatever is new. He had certainly been on the receiving end of that latter disposition when he was younger. His whole self-definition depended on not being like that. He was a revolutionary. He thought independent thoughts. He went wherever the truth led. He didn't want to be constrained by the heavy bourgeois style of the Berlin apartment he lived in with Elsa, or by the worst of her social climbing friends. He had made his own light and airy refuge up in the attic. He wore loose sweaters and often went barefoot around the house, regardless of whether visitors thought such casual behaviour beneath him. He was limited only by what he understood as the minimal, true structure of the universe. What he needed was one successful construction. It didn't even have to be built. It would be enough if he could describe it in words and show Bohr and Heisenberg that it worked. If he could do that, he'd be back where he knew he belonged, at the forefront, consolidating the truth, not anxiously trying to hold on to the past, simply because that happened to be what he was familiar with. And he knew in his bones that the universe had to have causality in its deepest structure. He was convinced of it. How then to show that was true? It helped that he could make almost any mechanical device work. He'd had years of practical experience analysing the most complex of devices in his patent office days. That would be his approach here. Heisenberg later recalled how Einstein went about launching his attack. They were all staying at the same hotel, he said, and Einstein had the habit of telling the others at breakfast about experiments he had thought up that would, he felt, undermine quantum mechanics. As Bohr, Einstein and Heisenberg walked to the conference hall together, they would make a start on analysing the assumptions behind Einstein's latest proposal. Heisenberg picks up. In the course of the day, Bohr, Wolfgang Pauli and I would frequently discuss Einstein's proposal, so that already by dinner time we could prove that his thought experiments were consistent with the uncertainty relations, and so could not be used to refute them. Einstein admitted this, but next morning brought along to breakfast a new thought experiment. Each time the new thought experiment was more complicated than the previous one, but each time by dinner the other men had managed to disprove it. And so it went on for several days. Einstein's close friend, Paul Ehrenfest from the Netherlands, was also at the 1927 conference, and shortly afterward he told his Leiden students about it. He loved listening to the dialogue between Bohr and Einstein. Einstein was like a chess player, he felt, coming up with ever new examples. He was a perpetual motion machine, intent on breaking through uncertainty. But there also was Bohr, who, out of a cloud of philosophical smoke, would lean forward, musing and musing, until he came up with the tools that could undermine Einstein's new examples. Sometimes when Einstein had devised an especially puzzling demonstration of why quantum mechanics had to be wrong, Bohr would keep Ehrenfest up nearly all night as he thought out loud until he found the flaw. The conference ended in a draw. Einstein had failed to find a counterexample that would refute Bohr, but Bohr remained apprehensive that this new theory on which he'd staked so much might still be undercut. On the way back to Berlin, Einstein consoled himself with the thought that the argument wasn't simply one of youth against age, with all the young physicists on Heisenberg's side and only old ones on his own. It helped that he shared the first part of the journey to Paris with Louis de Broglie, a dignified French physicist a decade younger than him, who'd done fundamental work laying out the principles behind quantum mechanics, yet who had the same doubts Einstein did. De Broglie, too, was convinced that Heisenberg's explanation was just a provisional step, and that somehow a core of certainty would eventually be found underpinning everything we saw. De Broglie had personal reasons to feel benevolent, for Einstein had ensured that his PhD dissertation, in which he had set out those ideas, had been accepted. The calculated results from quantum mechanics that Heisenberg and others had come up with were quite accurate, both Einstein and de Broglie agreed. But as Einstein repeated, "I believe that the limitation to statistical laws will be a temporary one." On the Gare du Nord platform in Paris, engaged in one of those long talks travellers have when neither wants their shared journey to end, Einstein repeated his points. De Broglie agreed, and as he left, Einstein called after him, "Carry on! You're on the right track!" In the 2 years following the 1927 conference, however, Einstein began seeing that his side in the quantum debate was losing popularity. More and more experimental demonstrations seemed to show that quantum mechanics worked. De Broglie himself only held out until 1928 before joining the consensus that Bohr, Heisenberg and the others on their side must be right. It was becoming a trend. The Austrian Erwin Schrödinger, soon to receive the Nobel Prize, was one of the few scientists to remain on Einstein's side. By 1929, however, Einstein had good reason to be more confident, despite his diminishing support. He was genuinely a modest man who knew his intellectual gifts weren't as extraordinary as the general public believed. Grossmann in Zurich, born in Göttingen, and many others were stronger mathematicians. If he, Einstein, did have good physical insights, that was because his family had raised him in such a distinctive way, open-minded enough to be critical of received opinion, yet grounded in the solid reality of light bulbs, electric generators, and all the other whirring apparatuses his father's and uncle's income had depended on. Lurking behind his insights may also have been his ancestors' only semi-forgotten religious beliefs, and especially the assumption that there had to be a waiting order and certainty, which at selected moments we were lucky enough to see. And from that mix, of which he had merely been the lucky beneficiary, he also knew that he had been able to probe beyond surface appearances to underlying principles that only much later had experimentalists found to be true. Einstein's E equals mc squared equation was now almost universally accepted, but there was something even better. During the 1927 conference, and despite Lemaître's claims, it had still seemed likely to Einstein that the lambda addition to his other great equation was necessary, that astronomers had been right, and his magnificently pure G equals T had to be discarded, that his belief in the power of sheer intuition was wrong. But just this year, in 1929, Hubble and Hummerson had published their new work, showing that Einstein's original, beautiful equation had been right after all. To Einstein, Hubble and Hummerson's findings changed everything. What they'd discovered with their great 100-inch telescope, that the lambda term wasn't necessary, showed that his original intuition there too had been right, that what he'd seen in 1915 about things altering geometry and altered geometry guiding things had been absolutely 100% true. Experimental results, all the assumptions of the world's astronomers, had seemed to show otherwise. But if Einstein had held out, he would have been proved right. Clearly, he believed he could hold out and be proved right again. He had already been disposed to believe that the universe had to be fundamentally knowable. His experience with lambda, showing that his initial intuition had been justified, provided an extra boost. Admittedly, there was a great danger here. The English essayist Macaulay once said of himself, accurately if not modestly, that he had an excellent writing style, but it was close to a very bad style indeed. This meant, he warned, that few of his readers should try to copy it, for if they got it even a little bit wrong, they would fail entirely. Einstein increasingly was taking a similar risk. Advancing from a belief that his intuition was right is what had made him the greatest scientist of the modern era. Yet holding only to that approach meant that his self-confidence could easily cross the line to sheer dogmatism. What's more, he was less constrained than ever in these issues. During his university years in Zurich, he'd had to be responsive to the best wisdom of the past. And during the years with Grossmann, he'd had to defer to a friend's superior mathematical talents. But now he found himself unshackled from these constraints, and more than a little untethered. Unless, of course, Einstein really was right. No one yet knew for sure. The world's top physicists only assembled in Brussels every few years. Since the 1927 conference had ended in a draw, when the next one arrived in October 1930, everyone's attention was on Einstein and Bohr. They were the two intellectual giants of their generation. Would they clash again, as they had at the last meeting? Einstein knew this was the last opportunity he would have to keep the community of physicists on his side, especially the young generation with whom he'd identified for so long. Yet in 1930, as at the previous conference, he remained quiet in the main meetings. Once again, he would only bring his objections to Bohr in the relative privacy outside those plenary sessions. In the meantime, the Dane worried. Bohr knew something big was coming, but how could he prepare? He simply had to believe that the newly developed science of quantum mechanics would be strong enough to stand against anything. Heisenberg steeled himself too. Like chess grandmasters before a match, he and Bohr and others had tried to plan every defence. Einstein too must have spent a long time preparing, puffing on his pipe in his Berlin study or at his country house, for what he came up with was tremendous. At the heart of quantum mechanics was Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which seemed to put a limit on the detail we could hope to see on the micro level. Without that detail, we could never be sure entirely just what was going to happen next. Heisenberg had first presented his principle as saying that one couldn't get complete accuracy in measuring a particle's momentum and position at the same time. It was, as the future Nobel laureate Wolfgang Pauli put it, as if we could see an object's momentum by looking out of our left eye and its location by looking out of our right eye, but would be stuck with a blur if we tried to keep both eyes open at once. Previous attempts to get around Heisenberg's principle had failed for the same reason that attempts to use a tire pressure gauge fail to give fully accurate readings. The very act of using the gauge lets air hiss out, and so changes the pressure inside the tire that you're trying to measure. Einstein's new idea was to step back and view the tire from further away, not using any sort of gauge or other device that would disturb it. Einstein's approach was akin to simply weighing the tire instead of measuring any air going out of it. He came up with a way to do this because recent work had also shown that Heisenberg's principle meant that one could measure a particle's energy or the exact time at which it had that energy, but not the two at once. This new finding about the uncertainty principle allowed Einstein to mount the most vigorous attack against it yet. For his new thought experiment in Brussels, Einstein came up with a device that would have done his old patent office supervisor Herr Haller proud. After they'd strolled away from the main meeting sessions, he told Bohr to imagine a box that had a fine cloud of radiation. Think of it as a cloud of light particles or photons floating inside it. There's a tiny shutter in one wall, controlled by a very precise clock. The whole apparatus is supported on a scale, so it can be weighed. When the clock strikes a particular time, the shutter opens, one photon is let out, and then the shutter closes. The box is weighed before and after, and that way it's obvious how much mass has been lost. Doing this, we know how much energy that lost photon carries. The scale tells us, because mass and energy are equivalent. We also know what time it is when the photon flies out. The clock tells us. This was something that should never happen if Heisenberg's uncertainty principle were true. Since the clock has no connection with the scale, unlike a tire pressure gauge where measurement interferes with accuracy, Heisenberg's argument is ruined. Certainty is possible. The classical world of cause and effect is saved. Bohr knew that he thought more slowly, albeit more deeply, than most others. But he was used to getting at least some feeling of what the solution to a problem might be. For Einstein's light-filled box, however, he could imagine no solution at all. The photon flies out through the shutter, the clock records the time, the scale moves. The clock and the scale are nowhere near each other. How could that be reconciled with Heisenberg's uncertainty? Einstein's thought experiment overwhelmed Bohr. As one contemporary recalled, Bohr was extremely unhappy all through the evening, walking from one person to another, trying to persuade them all that this could not be true. But he could think of no refutation. I will never forget the sight of the two opponents leaving the university club. Einstein, a majestic figure, walking calmly with a faint, ironic smile, and Bohr trotting along by his side, extremely upset. It was Einstein's last moment of glory. Bohr stayed up almost all night, no doubt dragooning graduate students or anyone else unlucky enough to be nearby for help, as he tried to mumble his way to a solution. Heisenberg had earlier described the way that once Bohr was focused on a problem, he would not give up, even after hours of struggling. So it was here. In the morning, Bohr had it. When the shutter opens and the photon flies out, the mass of the box goes down, but the weight of the box is being measured. That means it has to be on a scale. When the photon flies out, the scale rises up. Very little, but at least a bit. That means it's ever so slightly higher in the Earth's gravitational field. By Einstein's own theory of relativity, time is seen to operate at different rates in a stronger versus a weaker gravitational field. Bohr sketched out the calculations, and once everyone staying at the hotel saw where this was going, Bohr, Heisenberg, probably Ehrenfest, and perhaps others, Einstein, to his credit, helped them fill in the details. Working together, Einstein and Bohr concluded that the uncertainty in the weighing, because of that tiny gravitational shift, was just enough to match exactly what's predicted by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Einstein had neglected his own theory of relativity, and Bohr had used it to refute this final attempt to defend causality. It was a crushing blow, made all the more painful by the fact that it was delivered by Einstein's own instrument, and its implications could not be clearer. Back in 1916, Einstein had assumed that using probabilities to describe how photons operate within a device such as his proto-laser was just a temporary measure and would be put aside once science went further and our knowledge increased. That dream was now over. Heisenberg was exultant at the outcome. When he saw Einstein's last bastion crumble, he wrote, "We knew that we could now be sure of our ground. The new interpretation of quantum mechanics could not be refuted so simply." Bohr was the humbler man, but the gist of his polite, guttural mumblings was clear. He had won. Einstein had lost.